Welcome to 1 Samuel 17. This is entitled, The Battle is the Lord's, so the subtitle, Appearances Can Be Deceiving, as we go through chapter 17 of 1 Samuel, and it's a long one, 58 verses. Pay attention to how things appear to the various characters in this story and how David's view of things models what 1 Samuel 16:7 suggested, that the Lord does not look on the outward appearance, but on the heart. So let's begin. Some observations can be made, such as, how long is the story? Well, generally you look for things or words, key terms that are repeated that help frame the episode and tell us that this author is talking about this story within these verses. And that takes place with the word armies, which can also be translated place for camp in verse 1. And then again in verse 53, scholars call this an inclusio. Well, it's the longest story in Samuel, so 58 verses. We will be at it for a little bit. What's interesting is those 22 quotations, more than any other story that we know of. It's the longest quotation by an enemy of Israel, of course, Goliath. He gives a number of speeches, but one of them is 35 words long. There's attention to small details that color this story. The number of cheeses brought by David, do we know why? What was this number? We don't. It's not specified. The pieces and weights of Goliath's armor, why do we need to know that his armor weighed upwards of 125 to 150 pounds, except to suggest that he was covered head to toe, almost, in armor and was invincible. The number of small stones picked up by David, did he think he might need a plan B after the first shot? We don't know. Moreover, notice how outward appearance affects the characters in the story. If you look, if you pay attention, you'll find people looking at Goliath or looking at David and finding that there is more than meets the eye. Well, here's an outline. Goliath challenges the army of Israel in the first 11 verses of chapter 17. Then David, running an errand for his dad, hears Goliath's challenge and responds to it in verses 12 through 40. David ends up killing Goliath, as we all know, in verses 41 through 54. Then David is brought before Saul, who has asked, who is this youth, as David approaches Goliath? Well, maybe that he knew that he had a reward to pay, and that reward was a daughter. So this is finding out more about his future in-laws, perhaps, on Saul's part. Well, the setting begins with Saul. He was chosen king to save my people from the Philistines in chapter 9, verse 16. At the Battle of Michmash, Saul's foolish vow restricted Israel's victory and almost led to execution of Jonathan, his son. Do you recall that in chapter 13? They were in hot pursuit of the Philistines. Jonathan stops to pick up some honey to eat, and things go spiraling down from there as the Lord no longer responds, and the foolish vow that Samuel makes almost leads to the execution of his son, Jonathan. So he's been on his decline for a little bit, the king. He's rejected as king in chapter 15 as well. In fact, Samuel gives two different accounts of his rejection, first of a dynasty and then as his own kingship. And the spirit of Yahweh came upon David and departed from Saul. That's probably the key passage that tells us there is a change that has taken place. Saul is no longer in control. In fact, we find that there's a harmful spirit from the Lord that begins to torment Saul, and we find that in a couple occasions. So this spirit of Yahweh that gave power and direction to Saul departs, and all he has left is torment. And we'll find, as we go through this passage, Saul seems almost invisible as far as leadership or power. Well, Saul, Israel's king, was having major emotional problems and was alienated from Samuel, Israel's spiritual leader, and also from God. This meant Saul would not be able to give Israel good leadership in the crisis, says Butler. I think he's right. There's no inquiring of God. There's no priest to offer sacrifices. There's 40 days of stalemate instead. Well, let's talk about the Philistines for a moment. They were a constant threat from the summary in chapter 14:52. There was hard fighting against the Philistines all the days of Saul. So, and he never defeated them. He never finished his job. Well, the Philistine tactics here are probably the most detail we get anywhere in this long history of conflict with the Philistines. I think somewhere close to 200 years. But we hear that they deployed their forces, that they gathered their forces, that they drew up their lines, very general comments about it. And we wonder, why attack? Well, the Philistines had been pushed back in chapter 14. In fact, they had lost Gath and a few other places when Saul attacked and pushed them back from central Israel. But they needed more room, and they were encroaching on territory, as the words "which belongs to Judah" point out. So they were pressuring Judah. Now the Philistines, verse 1 through 3, gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Socah, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Socah and Azekah and Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and the Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with a valley between them. So here they are gathering for battle. And here's a quick map of the battle. Where those three colors meet is where the valley of Elah is. It's not all that far from central Israel. The valley was about a half mile wide. It was an important road both to Philistia on the coast, the Philistines, and to the Judean hills and Jerusalem for the Israelites. So, prime territory. And it was the entrance into Judean hill country. You could travel to Hebron and to Jerusalem through this route. Well, verse 4 through 7, the overwhelming appearance of Goliath. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits in a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs, and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and his shield-bearer went before him. It's an overwhelming appearance of Goliath that appears. Let's look at that a little bit. Well, he's called a champion in verse 4 and 23. Literally, it means the man between two armies, TWO, sorry. So the picture is of the Philistines on one side and Goliath, who is marched out ahead of them to face the Israelite lines and challenge them. Apparently he's done it before, or at least it seems so with the word champion. Gath was the closest village to Jewish territory, and, well, Gath is taken back in chapter 14, and Goliath would like to have it back. Well, the giant tops off at 9 foot 9 inches, some say 9.6 inches, depending on how you calculate the terms for measurements for height. There is some background to the giants. It's not enough that will satisfy most people. In Numbers 13, there's mention of the Nephilim. They were the sons of Anak who came from the Nephilim, who were stronger than us. That is the spies. In fact, the spies say they are grasshoppers in comparison. Joshua 11:22, there was none of the Anakim left in the land of Israel. Only in Gaza, in Gath, and in Ashdod did some remain. So Gath still, during the time of the conquest, had some giants. And later on in 1 Chronicles 28, There is mention of some who are descended from the giants, Ephraim and Gath. So this line continues for some time. And it seems to be where our giant Goliath comes from. Woodhouse makes this mark. Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature. 1 Samuel 16:7. But you might well wonder whether those words could possibly apply now. Here was height and stature that were not easy to ignore. Hard to annoy first impressions, isn't it? Well, it's an invincible appearance. The Philistines had the corner on metals, and so they had the technology for armor, a helmet of bronze. Most Philistine soldiers wore some kind of hat with feathers in it, so probably specially made for him. He had a coat of mail. Most Philistines did not wear a coat of mail, so again, he has the latest in technology. And bronze armor on his legs, or greaves are what they called it, protected his calf. So again, he is armored up and protected well beyond what the average Philistine would have worn in battle. Well, the weapons are mentioned in verse 6a and 7. We have a javelin and a spear of bronze. It could be a spear, or it could be translated as a scimitar, a curved sword. But David later removes Goliath's sword when Goliath doesn't need it after the battle in verse 51. So I think maybe it is a sword here. The spear, like a weaver's beam, maybe it suggests similar in thickness. It suggests perhaps a very large spear. And it may have had a loop or cord tied to it on the end so that when you threw it, you could throw it farther and more accurately it would spin because of the loop. Notice the spear's head of iron. It's 16 pounds. I don't know about you, but getting hit with something like that would have been incredible, devastating. And to top it off, he had a shield bearer who carried his shield in front of Goliath. So he is pretty well protected. Recall that in chapter 16, David is one of Saul's shield bearers, and one of Saul's shield bearers eventually dies in battle with Saul in chapter 31. Well, Goliath's physical stature, his armor, his weaponry, and shield bearer must have made him appear invincible. Indeed. Well, here's an application from an author. Oftentimes, the world seems to be armored so impressively against God's people and God's work. The world has the armor of legislators, laws, courts, news media control, peer pressure, national leaders, and other outwardly impressive powers to combat God's people and godly causes. When we behold this armor, we often become very discouraged. But we need not despair, for God's people are not without armor. To the natural eye, it may appear that we have no armor to speak of, but we can have the armor of God, Ephesians 6:11, the greatest armor of all. This was David's armor, and it proved much superior to any armor which Goliath had, says Butler. I think he's been paying too much attention to social media, but he does make a point. Goliath defiles the ranks of Israel, 8 through 11. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves, and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then you shall be my servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Let's look at this insulting challenge in verse 8. Why have you come out to battle? Goliath had already descended in the valley that separated the Philistines, and he was in front of the Israelites. He's ready for battle. And the reason why perhaps he thinks that they shouldn't be there for battle is because of who he is. I am the Philistine is the point. I've mistyped that, as if I am Mr. Philistine, the one example of the best example of what Philistia has to offer in the way of war. And are you not servants of Saul? By servants, Goliath means slaves. At verse 9, so perhaps it means that here. Ellsworth makes a good point. Talking to the Israelites, do slaves, Saul's slaves, really want to fight Philistines? Consider who you're fighting against, and consider who you're fighting for. Well, the challenge is for them to choose a man for yourselves. Now, if we recall in chapter 8, the man who was chosen was Saul. That was who the people had chosen. A king like the nations who would go out and lead beforehand. Woodhouse makes this comment, Saul was the closest thing that Israel had to a Goliath. Remember what he looked like when the people chose him. When he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward, 1 Samuel 10 and also 1 Samuel 9. To recall that Eliab was brought before Saul in chapter 16 to see if the Lord had chosen him, and what did they notice? He's tall. He's tall. He looks regal, like Saul. Well, what Goliath is offering besides trash talk, he's making a plea for representative warfare. It may be that because Goliath takes the time to explain it, that it was new to Israel. It's not real common in the ancient Near East for two armies to line up and for them each to choose a champion to do battle, and then the champion that lost, then his army would serve the other one. No doubt the Philistines knew they would ultimately win, but they didn't want to take the trouble of going into the hill country and digging out the Israelites, and it would cost them greatly, according to Longman and Reed. I think they may have a point. Well, we'll find later the Philistines broke the agreement in verse 51. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. Verse 52, and the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout and pursued the Philistines. Interesting. Well, let's look at some of this trash talk. Verse 10, Goliath is defying the ranks of Israel. In verse 9, the use of this term in connection with the brute from Gath helps us to view him properly. Goliath is not merely the big goon Philistia. Goliath's blabbering dishonors Israel's God, and we'll see that in a moment. To defy the ranks of Israel was to reproach Israel. It was to defy the armies of the living God, verse 26 through 32. There's something spiritual going on here. A.W. Pink suggests that Goliath pictures to us the great enemy of God and man, the devil, seeking to terrify and bring to captivity those who bear the name of the Lord. It's not far from what the ancient Near East thought of battle. The one that won, it was their God that won. And the people that lost, their God lost. Well, it's not just reproaching Israel, it's defying God. Verse 45, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied, said David. There is more than just trash talk that is brought here, and David is the one to point that out. Saul and Israel fear outward appearance. Yeah, they do. When Saul and all Israel heard, notice Saul is included in this, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. When we look at the physical appearance of things that are going on, we find that not only is Goliath, but the Philistine army was considered awesome. His outward appearance, his towering stature, his perfect equipment is overwhelming. On top of this, the Philistine army was well-trained, organized, and unlike the Israelites, sufficiently equipped with modern weapons. The Israelites didn't have much because the Philistines controlled the metal industry. Israel's leaders were frightened and ineffective. There's no mention of Saul or any of his captains like Abner or his son Jonathan or one of the other valiant men that Saul had been collecting in chapter 14. And Samara makes this comment, as a rule, the men below will reflect the spirit of their leader. True here. How about some application? When Israel focuses on outward appearances, their faulty focus obscures reality, stifles faith, and produces paralyzing fear. Well, how often do we focus on outward appearances and that stops us from doing what we know we should do? Well, David's family is mentioned in verse 12 through 18. Here's another group that looks at David differently than Saul, at least at this point. Verse 12. Now, David was the son of an Ephraite of Bethlehem in Judah named Jesse, who had eight sons. In the days of Saul, the man was already old and advanced in years. The three oldest sons of Jesse had followed Saul to the battle. And the name of his three sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and next to him Abinadab, and the third Shammah. David was the youngest. The three eldest followed Saul. But David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days the Philistine came forward and took his stand, morning and evening. And Jesse said to David his son, take for your brothers an ephah of this parched grain and these 10 loaves, and carry them quickly to the camp of your brothers. And also take these 10 cheeses to the commander of their thousands. See if your brothers are well and bring some token from them. So, what do we know about David's social status? Well, he appears defenseless and powerless compared with both Goliath and his brothers, and later also with Saul. His oldest brothers were in Saul's army. We find later his oldest brother makes a comment. Goliath is taking his stand morning and night for 40 days, so day and night, each day for 40 days, and no one responds. We find David running errands while this battle is going on. He's feeding sheep and brothers. Social status is pretty low here. Suggests that he's the youngest of eight, that he's too young for war, so he's probably less than 20 years old. He's qualified to feed his father's sheep. He has no military experience. He's the son of Jesse of Bethlehem. That appears in 16 twice, and in 17 verse 11 and verse 58. So the significance of Jesse and his where he comes from of Bethlehem will play an important part. He's further called this Ephrathite, which was a branch of the Calebites of Bethlehem in Judah, according to verse 12. So this comes up a couple of times, this branch, and it's important when things are repeated. While the giant's physical features, Philip says, are highlighted to impress us, it is David's covenant lineage that sets him apart. Even Saul recognizes this a little bit at the end of this chapter, wanting to know more about his father. And we'll find out more soon. Verse 19 through 23, David hears Goliath's challenge. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the Valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. And David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper and took the provisions and went, as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the encampment as the host was going out to the battle line, shouting the war cry. And Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. And David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage and ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers. As he talked with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before. And David heard him. Well, we find out in this passage is David is going to complete Jesse's commands, his instructions. In verse 22, he takes the provisions to his brothers and their commander. He sees if the brothers are well, and eventually he brings some token back from them, verse 54, perhaps Goliath's head, and perhaps some piece of armor for Dad to admire. Well, we find out in this passage his father does not seem to be terribly impressed with the anointing ceremony. Remember, his father and his brothers were all there when the great prophet Samuel anointed David, and yet here he is, tending sheep while his big brothers are off to war. To Jesse, David is still just a teenager, suited for war, for food deliveries or watching the livestock. But David is an obedient son, so he packs his bags and heads to the front line. So he takes the instructions seriously, despite all the excitement, and does what his father asks. bounty set for the death of Goliath is found in verse 24 and following. Let's read that. All the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches, and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." And David said to the men who stood by him, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in the same way, "So shall it be done to the man who kills him." There's a reward that's offered, a bounty. But let's look at what they saw up close. What did all the men of Israel see? They saw this man who's come up. They understand his purpose is to defy Israel, certainly after nearly 40 times, perhaps. And the man who kills him is going to earn a great reward. What about David? Well, this guy's an uncircumcised Philistine. He defies the army of the living God, so it's not just defying Israel, it's defying the living God. Important distinction. And he's a Philistine, and we need to remove this disgrace from Israel. What does Saul do? Well, Vinoy mentions this. Instead of attempting to motivate his troops by urging them to put their confidence in the name of the Lord, as David will do, he appealed to their desire for prestige and wealth. In effect, he turned the battle for the name of the Lord into a battle for self-interest. He was trying to bribe them. What was God's perspective? Well, David brings a whole new world. To this point, the narrative has been godless. But now David injects the godly question into the episode. Doesn't having a living God make a difference in all this? This fellow has mocked the ranks of the living God. If God is so identified with Israel, do you think he is indifferent towards such slurs on his reputation? Do you expect a living God to allow an uncircumcised Philistine to trample his name in military and theological mud? Good point. I don't think Goliath realizes what he's getting into. Well, verse 28 through 30, David's integrity is a question, and by who else? Your oldest brother. Now Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, "Why have you come down, and with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle." And David said, "What have I done? Was it not but a word?" And he turned away from him toward another, and spoke in the same way, and the people answered him again. Well, what did Eliab, his oldest brother, see in David? Well, it produced big brother's anger in verse 16:6 and 17:28. And I know, I is emphasized, so big brother is acting as a big brother with authority over his little brother. I, the best authority on this issue, your big brother, no better. He refers to Samuel's to David's occupation by saying those few sheep to remind David of his rightful role. He was the young, insignificant servant who managed sheep. And you're a little big for your britches. There's pride here, a presumption of your heart, he says. Eliab's next two charges are often used to describe human disobedience to God. So it's a theological argument that's made here. It's not just your pride, but your proud against God. He goes on, Klein says, David, who had dutifully carried out his father's instructions, is even accused of infidelity towards his job. So he does his job and gets blamed. And for an immature excitement at the thrill of warfare, David answered, proclaimed his innocence. He had only asked a harmless question. Perhaps it is Big Brother that is presuming a bit too much. Well, how about some application? In Liba's eyes, David was not a man of faith, but rather a self-serving, conceited individual in search of an opportunity for personal honor. Eliab's unprovoked attack on David, however, tells us more about Eliab's character than about David's, because Eliab sensed that his brother would not look with approval on the fear of Saul and his soldiers, including himself. He directed this angry outburst against him. My wife reminds me that, yeah, David's comments would touch the self-images of those around him who were not willing to voice such opinions, who were scared and fled from Goliath. Well, David convinces Goliath to accept a challenge. In verse 31 through 37. When the words that David spoke were heard, they repeated them before Saul, and he sent for them. And David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, and he has been a man of war from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep sheep for his father, and when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And if he rose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them. For he has defied the armies of the living God." And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." Well, let's look at David's words. How did it affect others? Well, he exhorted those around him, all of them who were older and more experienced than he, to stop being disheartened. Literally, let not the heart fail. Hard for older folks and those more experienced to accept exhortation from younger, isn't it? Well, Saul, how does he respond? The spirit had been taken away from him. He had no initiative for 40 days until David shows up. He must have been surprised and skeptical. What about David's testimony? "Circumstances vary, but Yahweh is the same, whether among the sheep or in front of the Philistines," says David. I think he's right. Notice the comparison between the paw of the lion, the paw of the bear, and the hand of the uncircumcised Philistine. Wow. How many of us have experienced something in the past that convinced us that God is indeed a deliverer, a savior, and we recall that in the present to encourage us and help us to press on, because remember Yahweh's provision or providence in the past, so we should, like David. Verse 38 through 40, David approaches the Philistine. Then Saul clothed David with his armor. He put a helmet of bronze on his head and clothed him with a coat of mail. And David strapped his sword over his armor. And he tried in vain to go, for he had not tested them. Then David said to Saul, "I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them." So David put them off. And then he took a staff in his hand, and he chose 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in the shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. Notice the equipping for David. When we look at this, what is Saul doing? He's trying to equip David like Goliath. Notice the similar terms used of a bronze helmet, of a coat of mail. And perhaps Saul is hoping for a victory, and maybe he could advertise on the web for armor that was better than Goliath's. Who knows? But David had not tested them. He's unable to move freely and normally is suggested by Amundsen, so he puts them off. It also suggests that he is making a point that he is not going to fight Goliath like Goliath fights. He is going to be without the weapons, the sword and the spear we find, and the sword and the spear we find later on. But David equips like a shepherd. He's talked about and being accused of being a shepherd. He adopts that injury, that insult, and applies it to his weapon. The sling, if you don't know, is recognized as a very useful weapon, one whose effectiveness should not be minimized. Indeed, the stones used in the slings at that time were 2 or 3 inches in diameter with a weight of a pound or more. So maybe the size of a tennis ball or baseball, they could be cast at 100 or 150 miles an hour and had a strategic advantage over a javelin or sword as a long-range weapon. So they were a long-range weapon. David was equipped for long range. Goliath was equipped for short range. Mano a mano. He's not going to be a little Goliath. So unlike all the men and Saul, he didn't flee from Goliath. He approached the Philistine. And here's the battle finally in verse 41 through 47. And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. Where have we heard that before? Chapter 16, when Samuel is brought to anoint David. And the Philistine said to David, am I a god, and you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and with a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give you, and I will give the dead bodies of the hosts of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all his assembly may know that the Lord saves not only with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. So let's compare these taunts or this trash talking between the two. When we read about the Philistine, he seems to be slower in his approach. The Philistine, 5 times in these verses. The Philistine went, the Philistine looked, the Philistine said, the Philistine cursed, the Philistine said again. It's taking some effort to get through his taunt. He obviously has contempt for David's appearance. He's a youth, he's ruddy, handsome, maybe even pink-faced, similar to what Saul said about David. He insults David's weapon. It's for spanking a dog. And dogs were typically wild in those days, so you might need a stick to spank them, or at least protect yourself. He speaks of his own resources. He does this by cursing David by his gods, perhaps Dagon in chapter 5, and Astartes in chapter 31. May have been the gods in mind, but it suggested that by cursing, you would gain power from the god over the enemy. He also promises a fate worse than death. What's worse than death? Well, having your corpse exposed to birds and beasts of the field because it remains unburied. It's cursed. Well, there's a quicker approach on David's side. He removes, he took, he chose, he put, he approached, and and just a little less than a verse, or a little more than a verse, he is quicker. Instead of contempt, he condemns what Goliath has done. He has defiled or insulted God, and according to Leviticus 24, it was a capital offense. He is aware of Goliath's sword, spear, and javelin. Seems like everybody is aware of that, but he's also aware of the true power that he has. He represents the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel. That phrase, the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, 3 times in this passage, 37 times in the Old Testament. Well, the promises are the same to Goliath, but more of it. We're going to include your buddies among the corpse, and we're going to not only give them to birds, but to wild animals. So whatever differences beasts of the field do to carcasses versus wild animals, It seems like to be a taunt of same to you, but more of it. Well, the motive, knowledge of the sovereign God who saves, not with sword or spirit, is why he is fighting versus the military fame that Goliath had. Interesting taunts. Verse 48 through 54, David prevails over the Philistines and the Israelites pursue the Philistines. Quite a turn of fate here. When the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell on his face to the ground. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword and drew it out of his sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. Then the Philistines saw that their champion was dead. They fled. And the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded of the Philistines fell on the way from Shechem as far as Gath and Ekron. And the people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camp. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. So let's look at the first part. David kills Goliath in the first couple of verses, 48 through 51. Goliath arose and came and drew near. Again, it's taking time for Goliath to get in place. David runs quickly. In fact, we find David runs quickly three times in this chapter, to camp, to his brothers, and to battle. And again, the preparation, Goliath is ready for hand-to-hand combat, or at least short to mid-range combat. Saul's weapons, Goliath's challenge, come to me, all suggest as much. But David took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. David's weapon was long range. The javelin, maybe 300 feet. Well, at least the archer is 300 feet. The javelin would be something less than that. 300 yards, excuse me. David's weapon, 600 yards. He could attack the giant without fear of being attacked by Goliath's weapons. Well, Goliath did not see David pick up the stone, and when he mentions David's weapons, he speaks only of sticks. There is no sling mentioned. So he was in for a surprise. Well, after Goliath is dispatched, we find Saul's interest in David's family line, verse 55 through 58. As soon as Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" And Abner said, "As your son lives, O king, I do not know." And the king said, "Inquire whose son the boy is." And as soon as David returned from the striking down of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant, Jesse the Bethlehemite." Why is this brought forth? Who is this youth? It's repeated three times in this passage, so it's significant. 55, 56, and 58. I think Kaiser is partially right because the bounty include the marrying off of a daughter. He probably was interested in his son-in-law's social status. Who is Jesse? What significance is his social status for this marriage? Then again, there's Saul's mental condition. Chapter 16, we find he is tormented by an evil spirit. Perhaps he forgot about whose father David was, or whose son David was. And then there was the busyness of life in court. We don't know how busy it was, how prominent Saul's presence was. He was brought forward when he was needed, even though the officials seemed to know of David fairly well. And he was known as a musician in chapter 16, a music therapy. But here he's presented as a warrior, and he's presented a warrior holding the severed head of a giant. I would say, who is this, even if I'd met them before, too. Well, David responds this way, the son of your servant, Jesse. It stresses that neither David nor his father was a traitor. After all, the latter had sent three and finally four sons into this battle. They were following Saul. His perception of Goliath was dominated by what he saw with his heart, not his eyes. This internal dimension was lacking in Saul and the Israelite army, not in David. Any comments you have, please email at johnston.bob@comcast.net. Lord willing, we'll look at chapter 18 next week and see how well David is received by the court.